place it comfortably. So good evening, everyone. Good evening, everyone on Zoom. So the theme of this talk, in a few words, is that there's basically nothing wrong with us. But let me introduce it as by way of a story. There was a person, a man who saw me in therapy once for quite a few years, probably maybe about 3 years, and then he dropped out of therapy, and he dropped out of therapy sort of feeling stuck and kind of feeling a bit dissatisfied, as though his issues hadn't been resolved. And then I happened to see him about another couple of years later, and the catalyst that brought him in is that his mother had died, so he wanted to see me again. But there was really something quite different about him, and he seemed much more settled and calm, and not as much sort of inward conflict or angst. And he said that what had happened in the meantime was that he realised he came along to therapy with the wrong assumption to it, and he thought there was something wrong with him, and that and if he spoke to me about it long enough, I'd work out what it was and fix it. Well, of course, I didn't have the tools to fix it. But he realised on his own that actually there was nothing wrong with him. And he realised that the more he burrowed in, that was the word he used, the more he burrowed in to trying to work out what was wrong with him, it's like it just got him nowhere, it just made things worse, you know. But his basic assumption was there's something wrong with me and I've got to work it out, and once I've worked it, everything will be fine. And not only had he made that shift, but he also said that there was obviously markers in his life, you know, where he was, his life had actually had improved in relative terms. You know, he had no debt, and he was much more settled in his job and things like that. So it translated into something practical as well. It wasn't just an abstract insight. And he also said, I got sick of thinking about myself all the time. And I reminded him, there's a friend and Buddhist colleague of mine who many of you might know, Bhante Tejadharma, who's a wonderful monk, Theravada monk. And he said that when he did his training as a young man in Thailand, the abbot used to come round to them every now and then, you know, and say, are you sick of yourself yet? And they didn't understand the question. They go, oh, no, I'm not sick of myself. And then a few weeks later, he'd come round again. He'd say, are you sick of yourself yet? You know, it's like, are you sick of thinking about yourself all the time and all your dramas and all the conflicts and all the thinking you bring to your life? Are you sick of that yet? And so what my client realised is what we always also realise through doing Zen practice, you know, is that you self-observe and you examine yourself, etc. But at the end of the day, you realise that there's nothing wrong with you. So you could, in a sense, you know, use these terms, and you could say that existentially there's nothing wrong with us. Because we like I said in the beginning of meditation, we can think that we're right or something's right about us or something wrong with us. But Zen insight is about, it goes beyond those concepts. You just are what you are. It's not in the realm of being fixed or wrong or right or whatever. That's what breaks down through Zen practice. But to put it in the context of our modern culture, I'm always trying to put Zen back into our culture now, rather than just living back in the tradition of what happened in Japan or China years ago. We live in a culture where more and more and it's talked about in newspapers more freely too. We live in a day and age where psychiatric diagnoses, that the terms become looser and looser and looser. You know, like, so you have post-traumatic stress disorder was something that you experienced through a life-threatening experience like being in Vietnam and being shot at. That's where the term actually arose from. Now you can get PTSD because someone's yelled at you in the street. You know? there's a common view. There is a view that all of these labels are becoming used much more loosely when all we're doing is talking about everyday life, grief, losses, stresses and so on that occur, and everyone's looking for a label for it to try and understand their behaviour, like am I on the autism spectrum or I'm AD or I'm depressed or whatever it might be. I'm sure that these things do exist. I know from personal experience what it's like for someone to be severely autistic. That was clearly something unusual about that, or for someone to be severely depressed. But when you get into the mild, moderate versions, it's a very vague area. There's no exact test to prove that someone's ADD or autistic or depressed. Not like there is like very clear tests that someone's got cancer or diabetes or whatever. There's nothing like that actually exists. So it's very vague and it's very grey. But what's happening is everyone's searching for a reason for their suffering. And I'm quite convinced of neurodiversity is that we're all just different from one another. It's just that we've got more fancy labels to describe how we're different. But everyone's got their weaknesses physically, like I get respiratory illnesses more easily than other people. Some people's kidneys are weak or they have digestive issues or whatever. And in terms of the way our brains function, yeah, well, we all are diverse in the way that our brains function. That's just the way we are. There's no perfect way to be. So it's quite possible some people produce more dopamine than others, so they appear to be like higher or happy. Some people produce more serotonin, so they seem calmer, or they produce more testosterone and they've got more motivation, you know, or drive, you know. Or some people produce more oxytocin, they're more loving. It's just the way the genetic cards fell, and that's the way you are, right? But there's nothing basically wrong with us, fundamentally. That's the insight that we come to through Zen practice. You take someone to like Hakuin Senji, and I mentioned I recently read an autobiographical novel about him, Night Boat. And Hakuin was a very unusual child. You know, I'm sure they would have diagnosed him with something when he was younger. Yeah. Very unusual child, and was so dedicated to practice, you know, doing long hours of sitting and sitting by himself and, you know, living in forests and caves as well as in a monastery. But at the end of the day, when he, through his realisation, he just thought that life was really funny. Right? He just laughed all the time, you know. Did he find something? And just realise that chasing his tail in a loop trying to become enlightened, you know, it's just going round and round and round. That's where you get to. It's like, what's the problem? It's no problem. Mm-hmm. So that's what we all come to, you know, eventually through practice. But if we understand this, if I use the word existential, if we understand our existential existence, there's two things that actually happen that shift us into a more joyful, playful, more settled kind of experience in our life. And they come from basic Buddhist concepts. Two of the marks of suffering, they call it, existential characteristics of life, is one that it's impermanent, and the other is that everything is empty. But that let me explain that a bit. If everything's impermanent, that often makes people feel like, oh, well, like suffering is caused by holding on to things, like it's a negative thing. But if you turn it around and you know in your bones that life is impermanent and you're not trying to hold anything, then what happens is that life is a stream and you're flowing with the stream. You're not trying to resist everything. So when you actualize life is impermanence and you embrace it fully, then something shifts. Mm-hmm. It's no problem. There's only a problem if you're trying to make something permanent and life keeps telling you that it's impermanent, right? Then you've got a conflict. If you fully recognize it's impermanent, there's no conflict, so no problem. And the same was also true of emptiness, but let's use that word and understand what it means. Emptiness means fundamentally to realize that life is empty of separateness. There's actually no separate things. Everything has a form, right? But everything is connected to everything else, and that's a basic Buddhist principle of interdependence, to give it a fancy name. Everything is empty of separateness. That's the nature of life. It's transient, and there's no separateness everywhere. So when we become one with the flow of life, there's a kind of a joy. There's no conflict there. And when we open to life, rather than be defensive and close in, you know, and tighten, the more we open up into interconnectedness and then connection, and with that love, right, then there's no problem either. There's only a conflict and a problem when we try to tighten down into this identity, into the self-centered dream, and we hold on to it. Mm-hmm. But if we're not trying to do that and we see that everything is empty of separation, then openness is what occurs. So flowing with life, openness to life, is what's actually happening existentially. Yeah, we may still have our own little psychological foibles. Mm-hmm. It might be a bit autistic or a bit ADD or whatever it might be, or depressed or whatever. But fundamentally, existentially, everything is okay. And that's where that's the transformation actually occurs if you do this practice long enough and see into it.